commercial success, employing people, offering a price. Actually, three birds with one stone. Commercially viable, you're employing people. Okay, you're offering a cheaper price to consumers, and you're solving a food issue. You're solving a waste issue. Sounds fantastic.
Touched on all 3 points.
I love it.
And cheaper.
Yeah.
There's nothing wrong with them.
No, that's right. In fact, there's something. I think there's probably a bunch of hipsters out there living in the inner west of Sydney and elsewhere in Australia that, you know, love the idea of, you know, of scavenging and finding things that are a little bit off the beaten track.
Yeah,
and,
that's,
you know,
true.
They probably love that. And, oh, look, this apple hasn't got any wax on it because it's an ugly shape. They didn't bother waxing it. Mm. I don't want wax on my apples. So there you go.
Now,
that'll plant the seed in someone's brain. And then my wife will say, why'd you say that on air? You know,
yes.
Anyway, because we're all too busy to do it.
As long as she helps you with marketing.
Thanks very much. Now, I wanted to talk about new floats, John.
Yeah, that's
and
great.
And all
idea.
These new floats.
I am surprised there are so many around at the moment when think that many would be pulling back or waiting.
Well, no, now the market's hot. It's run and...
For floats?
The float market, I would describe as absolutely white hot. I caught up earlier... or late last week with a good friend of mine who runs an investment bank in Sydney. He was telling me that they are as busy as they've ever been with floats. And to give you one example, we subscribe to the float of a real estate investment trust run by a group called Fife. I'm not promoting it. It's already closed. It was an industrial trust. Now, there's not many pure industrial trusts that are listed. To give you an idea, there was a particular block of units of about $30 million worth, and we were going to subscribe into that $30 million. They received subscriptions. The float was bigger than this, but one particular block was $30 million. The subscriptions for that block came to $250 million just for that block.
Goodness.
So it was 10 times more demand than there were stock available. Everyone was scaled back massively by up to 90%, and so people didn't get many units or many shares. But that's just one example.
If that is the case in a float, and you end up with a vastly reduced number of shares that you're trying to purchase, does that put a premium on the float price
itself? It can
itself?
Do. It can do. In fact, often the investment bank will advise the company, not often, but sometimes they advise the company to not issue as many shares and to hang on to a few shares for a couple of years after the float. And you see this in the US a lot. Facebook was an example of that, where a very small proportion of shares are issued because that creates demand. Mm. And if the company's big enough and there's enough float for it to get into an index, then there's just going to be natural buying from institutions anyway, because they've got to at least match the weight that's in the index, unless they want to be underweight that particular stock. Another example recently, last week, a company called AusForex floated. And AusForex is an interesting story because AusForex listed at a 28% or 30% premium. It does is it provides an online service, for people looking to transfer money overseas or buy foreign currency. And to give you an example, one of my colleagues at the office, his friend needed to transfer $200,000 Australian dollars into US dollars. Did $100,000 with AusForex and $100,000 with his bank, and the $100,000 with AusForex converted to $93,400. Don't quote me exactly on the hundreds, but $93,000 and some hundreds of dollars. And the bank gave him $90,000. So $3,400 difference between the online service and the bank. Now, this company, everyone sees great growth prospects for this business. They're expanding overseas. They don't need a lot of capital. We've talked a lot about businesses that don't need a lot of capital and can grow and throw a lot of cash off. And this is an example of a business that does that. So there's a whole range of businesses that are very attractive.
Extraordinary. It's one of those ideas that you wonder why it's taken now to really happen.
Well, it's been in business. They've been in business for a long time. They're only floating now. And the point is, actually, Gary Lord, who was one of the founders of the business, or one of the founding shareholders of the business. He was at BT with me, and there's a lot of people who have become very successful entrepreneurs out of that year or two that I was at BT in the early 1990s. Now, he has sold down his stake. In fact, all the shareholders on an aggregate basis have sold down about 92% of their shares. So they've sold out completely. Macquarie Bank was a shareholder in AusForex as well, and they've sold out. Now, that tells investors not to always go with the idea that because the founders are selling out that it's going to be a bad float. Another example that I can give you of that is way back in 2004, I think it was, a company called The Reject Shop listed. And I can remember buying shares in The Reject Shop at about $2.40. Now, they're listed at $2. And many of the founding shareholders were selling out or selling down significantly. Share prices recently hit $18.
Yeah.
So that's not an indication of whether a float's going to be good or bad, or a business is good or bad, just because the founding shareholders get out.
Yeah, often now, investors will go in for a specific period and a specific purpose, won't they?
Yeah, exactly.
And then once that's reached...
Well, stagging, for example, you can call it a strategy, but it's the bet that shares are going to list at a premium. We're not in the days we were during the technology boom. Yeah. I can remember in 1999, the average first day listing on the NASDAQ in the United States, the average first day listing of a new float was 90%. That was the average first day listing premium. So you basically wanted to buy any float and you'd make 90% on average on the first day. We're not nearly in that sort of situation.
But when we come back to the principles of investing in a float, I mean, I would imagine they would be mostly the similar principles that you're arguing.
They have to be the same, John.
But
is
there a difference of one or two in deciding to
float? I wish there was. I wish there was
a little bit different.
I wish there was a simple recipe for floats.
Because you don't have a track record.
Well, see, here's the interesting thing. A lot of people think that a float, when a company floats, it's a new business. It's not. Sometimes, in the case of AusForex, for example, or The Reject Shop, companies have been in business for years. It's just that they're new to the stock market. And a lot of people make that mistake. They think it's a new business. It's not a new business, it's just a new float. Now, with what are some of the companies that are listing? And then we'll talk about why you need to understand how to assess a float, and I'll go through that very quickly. But we've got Dick Smith's coming. Hoyt Cinemas is probably going to float from one of the private equity groups. Vader, which is a credit rating business out of PEP, Pacific Equity Partners, I think it's the private equity group. That's floating. You've got Genworth, which is the mortgage insurance business. If you borrow more than 80%, you have to take out mortgage insurance. These guys are the big insurers outside, other than QBE. Who else have we got? We've got a beef producer that's going to float. Channel 9 is looking to float. I'm very, very nervous about Channel 9. I personally, between you and me and the ABC and a couple of people that are listening, I wouldn't invest in a free-to-air television network. And the reason I wouldn't is because I liken the industry, and just, this is just my view, but I think what we've got is we've got three networks, arguably, that are commercial, and I think of them as three poker players in a closed gambling room with no windows and no doors and a set amount of money. The set amount of money represents the eyeballs of the Australian population, which isn't growing very fast.
No, particularly under the challenge of pay TV as well.
Yeah, exactly. Well, that's the fragmentation. So putting aside fragmentation for a minute of viewers, they've got a set number of viewers, and each year one of the networks, one of the card players, gets a really good hand, and the hand represents his suite of programs, and he gets a really great hand, and he wins all the chips, gets all the viewers at the expense of the other two, but then the cards are redealt, and another network gets a really good suite of programs at a really good hand, and all the viewers go there. And there's no net growth, there's no aggregate growth. Unless we double the population of Australia, you can basically assume that the value of these businesses isn't going to rise. And if you bring fragmentation in, and the idea that, for example, last night I didn't watch television. In fact, last week I didn't watch television. I was on the internet quite a bit, either working or my kids were showing me something on YouTube that was very funny that was sent to them or whatever it was. So the hours that I could be using in front of the television, arguably using them irresponsibly, but the hours I could be spending in front of the TV, I'm not. I'm doing something somewhere else. So the value of these businesses is declining. All right. Now, with a few minutes to go, how do you actually assess a float? Three things that you need to know. Number one, why are the vendors selling? Are they selling it to raise money to put into the business, or are they selling to get out? If they're selling to get out, as I said earlier, it doesn't necessarily mean that it's going to be a bad float. It just means you need to put on your skeptical hat and you need to ask yourself a few more, you know, you need to be more thorough in your investigation of the prospects for that business. Because typically I would say, well, these guys know the business better than anyone. They've been running it for years. Why are they getting out? Do they know something that I don't know?
They may not be getting out entirely, though. Is it the case of many that they're selling to expand the business prospects? In other words, reduce their total ownership and
provided the money's going capital. Provided some money's going into the business. But often it's the case that money is just going to them and it's not going in the business at all. So if they say they're using money for working capital, but then the money's not going into the business, it's going to the vendors.
I didn't know that.
Well, actually, it's in the prospectus.
Has to be in, yeah, that's
the
right,
the source and use of funds.
It has to be clear.
Has to be clearly identified in the prospectus. And usually in the first couple of sections, the first couple of pages of the prospectus, you're going to absolutely find that.
And you have to have a prospectus to,
yes,
to buy to into a float.
Correct. Mm. Unless you're going to... Oh, I'm not sure what the rules are about this, actually. If it's just going to sophisticated investors, you may only need an information memorandum. Mm. But ultimately, it's going to be owned by retail investors, so a prospectus is typically the way you go. Okay, so why are they selling and what are the funds going to be used for? Number two, what are the prospects for the profit of the business? And here's the other caveat. Has there been any changes to the year date, the change of the end of year? So is the end of year being switched from June to December or something funny like
that? I'm going to bite straight away. Why?
I get very suspicious when a company changes the year end date when it floats.
But wouldn't that be usually in most cases to comply with ASX regulation?
Sometimes, no, because there's
standard reporting period.
Yeah, but standard reporting period. But if they're switching, December can be a standard reporting period.
It can be, but it's an odd one.
Well, there's plenty of companies that report. It's just frustrating. The banks.
I know.
The banks don't report at June or December. Sorry to frustrate you, John.
But September and March are so much better.
But if there's some uncertainty around the prospects for the business, or there's some confusion around what the growth prospects of the business are going to be, and that's combined with the change of end of year reporting, it's a red flag for me. And then what I do is I turn to the risks page and I want to know what the risks actually are for the business. And you'll find there's a couple of pages of risks where they're actually specifically outlined. Do not ignore that. Make sure you read that. And then the third one is the pro forma balance sheet. Now, this is where you can actually see what's going to happen to the money. You can see how it flows through the business and whether there's been any revaluations or acquisitions at the time of the float in order to, if you like, dress up the balance sheet so that it looks good on a pro forma basis. So what the prospectus will show is what the balance sheet looked like prior to the float and what the balance sheet would look like assuming the float has already occurred,
right,
even though it hasn't yet. So they assume that all the money that they wanted to raise has been raised, mm-hmm, and it's been put into the business or given to the vendors, and you'll see how that flows through and changes the balance sheet. And that's really, really important. So they're the three things. Mm-hmm. The section of the prospectus that actually talks about the source and use of funds, mm-hmm, number one. Number two, changes to the end of year and the profit and loss outlook. Mm-hmm. And number three, the pro forma balance sheet.